Welcome to Mormon Happy Hour. My name is Colleen Dietz. Join me and my guests each week for an entertaining recap of the hottest topics in Mormonism. We keep tabs on social media and headline news so you don't have to. Don't miss our live pro tips as you adjust to your new and exciting post-Mormon life. Mormon Happy Hour is here to bring you the irreverent side of Mormonism, wherever you may be. Hello and welcome to episode 77. This one I am so happy to get out to you. This is a topic that I've been wanting to cover for so many months, and I finally found the perfect person to talk about it with, and I introduce her in the segment, so I don't want to take up too much time right now, but just trust me, this is a perfect episode. Now, while I do have your attention, please, please, I want to take a moment to thank each and every one of you for listening. I'm really feeling it this week. I really am grateful for all of my listeners. I'm really grateful for those of you who reach out and talk to me. I am just an ordinary human being that likes to garden and has kids, and I try and stay sane most of the time, and I also host a podcast. That's it. I'm pretty normal, and I am so excited to meet as many of you as I can when I am at Sunstone this summer. So I just wanted to plug that again so you can mark it in your calendars. Sunstone this year, the dates are July 31st through August 3rd. So Wednesday evening is the opening ceremony, and then it's all day Thursday, all day Friday, and all day Saturday. So what I am thinking while I am in town, I would love to have a meetup. We're thinking Friday night would be the best night to do it. And I am looking at pairing up with Bryce Blankenagel from Naked Mormonism again to do a little evening get together. We wanted to be intimate so we can get to know you and kind of, you know, mingle, and not so much a structured live show. So if you are interested in that, we would love to meet you. So Friday night, we're thinking for that. And then I also wanted to do just a coffee date because I love coffee dates. So we're thinking Saturday morning before Sunstone really opens up and gets going, doing a meetup at a nearby coffee shop. So if you would love to be there, please let me know so we can know what kind of interest there is and kind of get a head count. Reach out. You know how to find me. My voicemail is 435-494-1427, or you can reach me through the website, angelsonfire.org, or through Facebook. We have a group, and we have a page, and there is an Instagram account at Mormon Happy Hour, a Twitter account at Mormon Happy Hour, and I think that's just about it. I also have a Venmo account if you're into one-time donations, and that's just at Mormon Happy Hour as well. And I'm looking at making all kinds of merchandise to have for you at Sunstone. Last year, none of it came in time, and I was so sad, but this year I will have all of it, and I can't wait to share it with you. So yeah, hopefully I see you, and that's about it for the Sunstone plug, and for thank you so much for being listeners, for reaching out, for being so such a supportive community. You really make doing this podcast so much fun. And hey, I have been thinking about the direction of Mormon Happy Hour, and I feel like a lot of my episodes lately have been a little bit more on the serious side. So I wanted to get back into some humorous topics, and so I would love to throw it out to you guys to nominate some happy aspects of leaving Mormonism and some things that we can, I always find healing in humor. So tell me what's some funny things that you've come across. Send them my way. I'm always open for suggestions. So without further ado, please welcome April Carlson. Welcome to Mormon Happy Hour. I have a special guest with me today to talk about a wonderful topic that I am excited to, well, I don't know about wonderful. I don't know that that's the word I would use. An interesting topic that I think impacts a lot of us, if not all of us. So April Carlson, welcome to Mormon Happy Hour.
Hooray! Hi.
How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Yeah, like it's my kind of Sabbath where I've slept in and been to the Temple of Trader Joe's and picked up some yummy food for the week and
nice.
Off to a good start.
That sounds awesome. So, April, we were connected by a good friend in the, of both of ours, I guess, in the Exponent group, on the Exponent right. Facebook group on Facebook. And so we have kind of stumbled across something that we both really relate to. But actually, before I get into that, let's talk about like what you do and your unique view into like, I don't know, Mormon culture and these type of issues that go on.
Sure. Don't worry. So, yeah, I'm a therapist professionally. I work as an inpatient social worker at Huntsman Cancer Hospital as kind of my fuller time gig.
Mm-hmm.
And then I work at a private practice called the Healing Group, where I work with a lot of women around maternal mental health. Mm-hmm. And end up seeing a lot of people in faith transition.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's good work.
Hi. Yeah, and like that, like to specialize in faith transition, like that's a huge tumultuous change in someone's life. Like you really see into the petri dish of this particular issue.
So what's really interesting is kind of how I got into it was that I moved to Utah from Los Angeles, where I had worked for Department of Children and Family Services for 8 mm-hmm. years. And while I was there, I'd specialized in two areas, child sexual abuse, and then in recruiting families for older youth to be adopted.
Mm.
And so a lot of the work that I did with teenagers was helping them to let go of their attachment to their family of origin, being able to grieve their drug-addicted parents who are never going to be able to be their parents again, mm-hmm. And really prepare them to have their birth certificate invalidated and to be legally freed for adoption, yeah. And to have new names go on to their birth certificate, new parents. So in this space where an adolescent should really be detaching from adults and becoming independent, mm-hmm. Instead they have to get really vulnerable and connect to adults and bond to these new parents. So it's a really big deal. It's a hard thing to do and some really intense grief work. And as I moved to Utah and really like hit like turbo on my faith transition, mm-hmm. I'm just like horrified at what I found on the mothership when I came here.
Wow.
It's just so much is similar to the work that I was doing with teenagers, where it's letting go of this family of origin that hurt you, that wasn't nurturing, that wasn't supportive, that wasn't true in the way that you needed it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And really trying to open yourself up to be able to attach to and connect to kind of a new family. So a new religion, new people, and to do that, you really have to have grieved all the loss. You have to have named the things that suck and spent time feeling all the feels about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that grief process, one of the things that has definitely come up for me has been how I relate to women and how I was taught to think about my relationships to other women.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so you said that you went through your own faith crisis then when you moved from Los Angeles to Utah?
Yeah, and really, I mean, like I did my undergrad at Berkeley, which is a pretty liberal place to be Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was exposed to Mormon feminism like at 18, 19 years old, that I was reading Women in Authority, mm-hmm. grieving that women had lost the power to bless, to anoint, that expressions of Mormon women's priesthood were no longer part of the faith that I practiced. And
wow.
You know, it's like, I've been in faith transition for like 20 years, you know, like I kept finding reasons to stay. You know, like Mormons are my people, and there's a lot that I love about the community. It was not easy to leave, but moving to Utah and really being surrounded by Mormonism in a pretty awful ward with a lot of wealth, a lot of white privilege, a lot of over the pulpit racism, just. Like, we're so lucky to be white and descended from Mormon pioneers. That was a lot of ick, and, you know, kind of my last gig with DCFS before I moved here had been investigating child sexual abuse. And I landed in primary in my first Utah ward. And I'm just sitting and sharing time, listening to the lessons we were teaching children about being perfectly obedient, about trusting adults, trusting those with authority. It just started to feel like what was wrong with like so many kids who had been molested, who'd been abused. They'd been vulnerable because they were good kids. You know, they were the ones who got good grades, who always listened to their teacher, who just trusted adults and tried their best to please them. And doing that, it got them, you know, not like it was their fault, but it just, it made them really vulnerable. They were easily groomed, easily seduced, easily abused. And it was hard to get to the truth and just feeling like, wow, like by making this space more comfortable, by being a kick-ass primary teacher, and helping these kids to feel happy about being here, I'm colluding in their future abuse. You know, like I'm helping to teach them to be vulnerable, to not know how to speak to power, to not trust their gut, to not trust their intuition. It got really hard. So yeah. I continued to attend like a good, I'd say like a good year and a half, 2 years after I was really, really done with all the doctrinal belief. Kate Kelly getting excommunicated to me was a really loud message that I wasn't wanted in the church, that people who ask questions, who envision a spiritual community with equality, they don't belong in Mormonism. And yeah, I kept reading the comments, which you probably shouldn't do, in the Deseret News, in the Tribune, and, you know, over and over again, people are just, you know, like, if you don't like it, leave. And, you know, I taught primary every other Sunday and started visiting other churches on my Sundays off. And every church I visited, I felt so good. It was like, wow, like, I feel the Spirit, but, like, I feel the Spirit, like, on crack. Like, this is... like, this is so much love and goodness, and how can this be? And it didn't matter if it was the Presbyterians or the Unitarians or the Episcopalians, just everywhere I went felt so much better to me than the Mormon church did.
That's crazy. Yeah, which means, so, to me, from an outside perspective, what that means is, like, I mean, I have kind of a secular look on spirituality at this point in my life, but to hear you say that, that experience, to me, that means that that spirituality was coming from you, and that there was something in the Mormon culture that was stifling that spirituality, and you were able to tap into it in any other setting. You could tap into it, but not within Mormonism.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting. So where are you now? What do you do now? Like, what brings you here? Yeah. Enjoy now?
Mountain church, being outside, puttering in my garden, observing the seasons, trying to have a lot of ritual around the movement of the sun and the stars. And I've got a big vacation coming up this next week. I'm gonna climb the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan in Mexico on the spring equinox. And
beautiful.
And I don't know that it's magic so much as just making time to honor inside of me a need for balance, celebrating that winter is ending and spring is coming, that it's a time of new beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I also celebrate solstice and, you know, and try to, I feel like the work that I do as a social worker and as a therapist is very holy work where I'm talking to people about life and death and what matters most to them on a pretty much daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of feel like I kept my spirituality and just lost religion and lost, you know, lost some community, lost a lot of people-pleasing power. You know, I have lots of active Mormon family that are very disappointed that I'm no longer active in the church. And
it's too bad.
You know,
yeah.
No, we don't get to talk about general conference and scriptures or
things
that took a lot of our time before. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that is the evolution of a faith transition within a highly Orthodox family for sure.
Yeah.
So you and I, we got together, we started talking about this topic, and this is something that this topic of, I want to call it like Mormonism ruins girlfriends for me. At how relational aggression, as you termed it, within the LDS culture, basically just makes things so difficult, especially for women, to really form bonds and friendships within our gender. So I came, as we were kind of setting up plans to talk, I came across a post by Mindy Gledhill on Instagram. Now, Mindy Gledhill, you're familiar with Mindy, correct?
Yes, I went and checked out the Instagram, yes.
So she is a formerly LDS-focused recording artist from Provo, Utah. She has some beautiful music. She has a very soft and melodic voice, and she's just... it's magical. And I've been a fan of hers for at least a decade. She's amazing. Yeah. When I was a Mormon, she was definitely one of my favorites.
I know I've had lots of clients that were like, oh, she was my favorite to listen to on my mission. Like
Yeah, she was approved music on many, many missions.
Yes, she was.
So she released an album focusing on her faith transition in January of this year, and it is entitled Rabbit Hole, and it's glorious. I will put a link to it in the show notes. It's streaming, or you can buy it. It's out there. And she's also touring, so I'll be seeing her live here in Arizona in May, so I'm really excited. So check out her tour or her website for her tour schedule. Maybe you might be able to see her. So anyway, I wanted to read what she wrote because it's a bit long, but bear with me because it perfectly puts into words my experience as well. And so I thought, you know, I'll just read what Mindy wrote and it'll be so much more beautiful. So here's what she said. And she made this post on March 8th, which was coincidentally International Women's Day. So this was her tribute. Within the pattern of a rigid patriarchal upbringing, I learned to distrust women. Women did not hold any positions of authority in my church, nor did I see many governing my country. Growing up, it was difficult for me to make friends with women for very long. If I was, quote, one of the guys, I felt more empowered, which only increased competitive sentiments with other women. I didn't recognize the brokenness of this paradigm in my life until well into adulthood, and I've been trying to make amends with females and non-males ever since. When I think of the femme friendships I have now, compared to so many of my previous years on this planet, I feel overcome with emotion and gratitude. I'm still working on trusting women, LOL, and men, and humans in general. I'm pretty introverted, and now I'm rambling. But all this to say, happy International Women's Day to all of the incredible women who inspire me every day. And that is on Mindy Gledhill's Instagram account. So I just really, really love that, because to me, as April and I were going back and forth about this topic, I saw this and I'm like, oh, that's exactly our topic. This struggle as a woman to trust one another and really find that depth in a safe place. And so April, you actually, as we were speaking also, came out with an excellent piece that was published in The Exponent. And for any of you that aren't familiar with The Exponent, April, do you want to briefly talk about what The Exponent is?
Sure. Well, it was originally a Relief Society newspaper back in like Brigham Young times, which mm-hmm. a group of women doing research for an institute class in Boston came across in the Harvard Library. And then they started a newspaper magazine, The Exponent 2, that still publishes quarterly. Mm-hmm. And about 10 years ago, they started a blog version of The Exponent, which is where I participate blogging, which I've been doing for a few years. And then there's a pretty active Facebook group mm-hmm. Where a lot of like the day-to-day discussion is happening. Mm-hmm. And then the Exponent community does a lot of women's retreats around the country. So like a big one in the Boston area, like up in the woods of New Hampshire. And then there's like a Pittsburgh, Chicago area. And then some here kind of in the Utah area as well.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I think the Exponent 2 discussion group on Facebook is pretty much my favorite space on Facebook by far. And it's funny because I didn't discover the Exponent until I had kind of already fallen out of love with a lot of other feminist mm-hmm. Mormon spaces on Facebook. And I yeah. just felt this like, well, maybe I'm not a part of that. And then I discovered the Exponent 2 group and I'm like, this is my home. Like, this is perfect.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how it's a group of very diverse women. There's a lot of post-Mormons and a lot of active Mormons, and everybody works yeah. together. Everybody gets along. The conversations are amazing. So I really, really love the work that Exponent 2 and all of you who blog and admin and kind of keep it all rolling. It's such a gift to our community. It's beautiful.
It's hard work keeping that diverse group of women functioning. You know, I think we are really trained from a young age to not trust other women. You know, like, women are not who we go to for healing. Women do not have authority. You know, like, men are the ones in power, and your power as a Mormon woman is really determined by your proximity to priesthood power.
Exactly.
And ultimately, like, being able to attract and keep the attention of, you know, like, the most spiritual, like, most powerful spouse. And, you know, that looks like wealth, you know, like, lots of people who are bishops or stake presidents or move up higher tend to higher incomes. And it gets really fierce as women compete for the attention of men and that future and really salvation, where, you know, like, ultimately we're saved through our spouse's relationship to Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny that you mention, like, this proximity and this like fighting for men's attention. I always attributed before I really understood the impact Mormonism culturally had on my life, I always attributed my difficulty having relationships with women on a poor relationship with my mother growing up, which I'm sure had a lot to do with it. But then when I take a step back, then I look at, well, what kind of relationship did my mother have with her mother? And what kind of petri dish pressure cooker situation was that? And then when I look at it, I'm like, this is generational. This is generational. It's cultural. It's not something that I can just blame on my mom. Like, not at all. Like, we're all kind of victims of the same thing. And
yes.
And so it's interesting, and it gives me a lot more compassion, I think, towards my mother to really understand the root of, you know, my difficulty with women, my difficulty with relating to my mother. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I can work through this. We can grow and heal. And,
yeah.
And it's not like, it's not this base hatred that I always felt. Like, that's not true. There's a lot of reacting to fear and, you know, and survival that's going on. So I don't want to ramble too much, but I did want to give you an opportunity. There's a lot of things at the beginning of your article that I really love. And I'm going to put the link to your article, obviously, in the show notes.
Yeah.
And so the first part you describe kind of from a large, you know, from a far out perspective, you kind of describe what relational aggression is and what it looks like. And you do a really great job. Do you want to maybe give a little bit of a synopsis here so that our listeners can kind of follow along?
Yeah. Anybody who's familiar with Mean Girls, the movie or the musical, or, you know, has watched any John Hughes movies from like the 80s, 90s, where you see like the popular crowd and how they use relationships with one another to cause harm and to also try to broker power. And so where relational aggression really thrives is in spaces where physical violence is not as accessible or isn't as readily used. So relational aggression is the way that violence is expressed. And it's through emotional attachment, which for women, where you know, so much of our identity comes from how we relate to others, how we connect to a community, to a village, that will ultimately help us to keep our offspring alive and surviving. So it feels really important at this biological level, you know, where it's life or death connecting. Connecting to others, connecting to leaders of groups, to people who have power to facilitate my connection to others. You know, like being connected to the matriarch of the village means there's access to food, to healers for my children when they're sick. All these ways that our bodies are really primed to look for these kinds of connections and to work hard to hang on to them. And because they're so important, anything that triggers our sense of being shunned, isolated, cast out, can feel like death, can feel like our life is being threatened. And, you know, evolutionary, that triggers like a fight, flight, or freeze response. And if you're in a situation where you don't have power, then, you know, running away or fighting isn't an option. And so what freezing looks like is this frantic friending of Mean Girl. You know, like it's baking cookies for the monster. It's trying to get the approval of someone who is awful to you. And what makes it especially traumatic and really stores it in our body in a way that you're going to end up in a therapist's office to work through it, is when there's this combination of fear and being trapped. And so you're afraid, but you can't move, you can't get out, you can't escape. And in a Mormon setting where our wards are based on these geographic boundaries, you literally can't get out unless you leave the ward and choose to move to another ward where you won't necessarily be able to have a calling. You don't have any other options.
And then you go on to kind of relate it specifically to Mormonism. And if you don't mind, I want to read a little bit of an excerpt of your words.
Yeah.
So you say, Mormons are especially prone to relational aggression because of the hierarchy of priesthood power and how that power is expressed. A hierarchy of leaders determines worthiness and belonging through subjective judgment or discernment. A criminal can be called as a leader. The best human can serve in beta callings for a lifetime. The lack of transparency around who receives or is released from a calling breeds opportunity for rumor and judgment. The secrecy of a disciplinary council or simply the assignment of ministering teachers creates conditions for exclusion. In the absence of transparency, it is easy for an influencer to create prejudice around a target being the person who, you know, is feeling attacked.
Yes, he's the victim of, yes.
Right, of this relational aggression. So they can create prejudice around a target with rumor and conjecture. And it is the perfect storm, because like with all this lack of transparency, all you have is rumors, and who's not to believe you? And especially if you're a woman in close to power, like if you're the bishop's wife, even if you're making shit up, people are going to believe you because of your position.
Right.
And your relation to the actual power, which is the priesthood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, that was very, very powerful. And then do you want me to keep going, or did you have anything that you wanted to jump in and say?
No, I think it's that power is limited, and who has access to power. Mm-hmm. That really creates, these ideal conditions for relational aggression. You know, where I work in a hospital, I've certainly seen this happen in nursing, and some of the people who've been more active in relational aggression research are, PhDs in nursing. And so they've done these studies, like on hospital floors amongst nurses where, it's a very high stakes, life or death kind of environment. But it's the doctors who have a lot of the power, and because the nurses are not empowered to kind of speak back to that power or to equally share that power, there'll be a lot of, turning against each other. Things like not cleaning the room for the next nurse who's coming on for her shift. And in the Mormon world, it's, again, that limited power. And just little whispers, just gossip can do so much to influence what a bishop or a stake president chooses to do. Like for women, you really can just be excommunicated by a bishop. There doesn't even have to be this stake level council and trial. There's just... The power is so fragile that it makes it really, really easy to end up a victim, even for somebody who's very savvy in navigating social spaces.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the thing that I found particularly interesting with the study on the floor of hospitals is obviously the nurses versus doctors is a very gendered role. Nurses. Mm-hmm. Are very stereotypically and high percentage female, and doctors are very stereotypically and high percentage male. So that adds to this, not only is it's the power and it's the gender. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep reading just a little bit. I really like your article. Okay. So then you go on to say, the intentional severing of connection has devastating consequences, as evidenced in many clients paying for mental health services to treat the emotional injustices of relational aggression. When we are at our most stressed, moving through life transitions such as marriage, parenthood, new employment, losing our faith, death of a loved one, we are at greatest risk of being triggered by shame into a mental health crisis. This is when we need connection most, when we need our voice to be heard, when we need to be received with empathy. And then you go on to talk about the shame researcher, Brené Brown, and how she describes secrecy, silence, and judgment as the petri dish that allows shame to grow and thrive. She identifies scarcity culture, which is totally Mormonism, as a multiplier that exacerbates these conditions. Relational aggression feeds shame with the othering message that a target does not belong. In the receiving end of relational aggression, we are isolated, rejected, and othered. There is something wrong with us that causes our people to reject and harm us when we need them to survive. Like these words, they embody Mormon culture. Like we're taught to use shame and exclusion as motivation to encourage people to change and conform, to be part of the crowd. Like that's an actual tool that Mormonism uses very actively.
I would describe shame as the primary instructional tool of the Mormon faith.
Yes.
The bishop's interview, general conference addresses, so much is intended to shame that mm-hmm. it's to make people feel at their core that they are flawed and broken and unworthy mm-hmm. and completely dependent on the atonement of Jesus Christ to be acceptable, and that your access to that atonement has to go through your priesthood leaders.
Yes, that there's the priesthood leaders are always the intermediary between you and God. You can't just like yes. you. There has to be the repentance process. It has to include the bishop,
right?
You know, and the bishop.
Your temple recommend has to be signed by a leader. Yes.
You can't. You literally cannot access heaven without first being cleared by your local bishop. Like, it's gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those are all of the excerpts that I pulled out. Did you have any thoughts about all of that that you wanted to talk about more about?
I mean, like some of the different scenarios that I described, have broken my heart. You know, like I see so many new moms, especially who are experiencing postpartum depression mm-hmm. Or anxiety, but you know, like their mental health has been impacted by the birth of the child, and who go to Relief Society presidents, who go to people in their family looking for help, and just get these messages of, oh, this is your first baby. Sister so-and-so has 7. She's coping just fine. Or, you know, Sister so-and-so has this many babies and cancer. And just a lot of diminishing what people are experiencing. Or just, if you would just pray more, it's that you're unworthy. It's that you're not righteous. You know, like you just need to have a more positive attitude and try harder. And underlying that, the person who's giving, who's delivering that message, that's some intense violence. That's real emotional violence that is just shoving that person out of the village, out of the community, saying there's something wrong with you, you're other, you're not doing mothering the right way, you're not feeling blissfully happy because you're sinful, because there's something fundamentally wrong with you.
That's so heartbreaking. It's such a heartbreaking message that, like, I try really hard to say, well, you know, there's not everyone in the Mormon church is like that. But
right.
unfortunately, the people that aren't like that become the others. They become othered because they don't conform to the cultural norms. So they're there, but they're marginalized.
Yes, they are. And then with faith transition, that's another delicate time for mental health, where people are so vulnerable. One of the things that happens in faith formation is that a normal stage of development is usually in adolescence to begin questioning, testing, doing some rebelling, and trying to figure out if the things that your parents and other authority figures have taught you, are those things true? Do they make sense? Do you want to keep them as you move into adulthood, kind of solidify in who you are as a person? Mm-hmm. And for Mormons, you get baptized when you're 8, and you're foreclosing, like you're accepting belief and committing at an adult level as a child. And so a lot of this testing, rebelling, it never happens because we've shut down in this adolescent phase. And there's something about that having shut down in an adolescent phase and just having adopted the groupthink, you know, like whatever the church leaders believe, that's what I believe. Like we're all united and together in believing things the same way. Every Mormon church building you go to around the country, you'll get the same lesson, you'll sing the same hymns. This sameness that we really celebrate and revel in, and it also really lends itself to the teenage mentality of relational aggression, that insecurity, that using power to punish people for daring to think other, for daring to question the groupthink, for, you know, having any behaviors, thoughts, desires, wishes that don't fit with with what's considered the group norm. Mm-hmm. So for people who begin to question and have doubts and are really exploring faith or just beginning to say, so maybe I don't know. I hope a lot of things, but I'm not so sure. I don't think I do know these things that I've been testifying to. Mm-hmm. And that there isn't a space to receive them and allow them to explore that. And, you know, instead, you know, again, like your visiting teacher, ministering teacher, home teachers, your bishop, your relief society president, or just your friend from church will say things like, your countenance has gone dark. Satan is working upon you. Mm-hmm. You've fallen under the influence of the adversary. There are all of these emotionally violent statements of you do not belong to the body of Christ. Like you are out. You are other. You aren't part of us anymore.
It's really, really sad. And I, even as you're talking, I'm having a really hard time because I want to say, oh, but that's just church culture. But then I remember that we talk about how this comes across the pulpit at General Conference. And how is that not doctrine if it's coming across the pulpit? And, you know, even if you look at the handbooks, Handbook 1 and Handbook 2, that hold all of the rules that we are held accountable by mm-hmm. as Mormons, like, number one, there's a lack of transparency in those handbooks. Those are not accessible to, you know, like, even though Handbook 2 is technically anybody can read it, people don't, you know, like, it's mm-hmm. not common knowledge. And so, again, that lack of transparency, like, all of these things just kind of, like, suffocate and take away authenticity, and they create just people that are just conforming to this one this one perfect-looking person, and that's how everybody has to look, and everybody has to believe the same. Everyone has to have the same beliefs, and that's something that I always struggled with in Relief Society. Is that it was such a hard place to have a conversation, an authentic conversation, and share your own feelings, because, like, if you got really into, like, oh, this is how, like, I'm getting in tune with my own feelings, like, along the line, somewhere you're going to say something that isn't quite exactly what, you know, we're taught. And that one little thing is going to immediately other you and set you apart. And you might get a little conversation, or you might get called to the bishop's office, even as an adult woman, for something that you said in a comment. Right. Like, it's just so juvenile. How was that not a high school setting? Like, exactly what you were saying. Like, it puts you back in that teenage mentality constantly. All of this monitoring, self-monitoring, other monitoring, like, it's a very self-policing culture. Like, everyone's mm-hmm. has to monitor and make sure everyone else is walking the line. And if they're not, like, we're counseled that if you love someone, then you need to turn them in for their own good. And it's heartbreaking.
Yes, I think about people who kind of voiced an idea from the margins, you know, who were able to kind of step out of that secrecy, the silence, the judgment, that petri dish that's feeding shame. Mm-hmm. You know, our stake relief society president, when I was in Young Women's, came to girls camp, and she was the one who taught us to play poker. And it was okay because it's the stake relief society president, you know, like, she's proximate to power. So it's all right that she's kind of at the margins doing something a little wicked and rebellious. Or like, maybe, you know, when I was still active in church in Los Angeles, the wife of one of the bishopric members shared, I think it was in a talk, how hard it was for her to go to the temple, and how almost every time that she goes afterwards, she goes to her car and cries for like 30 minutes, where she just finds it so painful. And, you know, like, what she was saying, I'm like, oh, if I went up there and said that, like, I'd be in the bishop's office, you know, like, that there'd be trouble. Uh-huh. But she was the daughter of the stake president from, like, a neighboring stake, and she was married to somebody who's in who's in the leadership of the ward. Mm-hmm. And so with her power, she was really able to open up this space where we could talk about imperfection and how not everybody who goes to the temple has an amazing experience. But she's very much the exception. You know, that's not the rule. That's not what happens. And it would have been so different if somebody with less power and less proximity to power had been saying it.
Yes.
And she was using her power in a way to open up space, to include, to draw people in and, you know, like name something that, hey, like I struggle with this in case any of you do too. Like, here I am speaking it. But more often what happens is that people are pushed out and punished for sharing that they struggle or that something is hard for them. Mm-hmm. And then so much gaslighting, you know, like where you're on the receiving end of like the mean girl behavior. Mm-hmm. And when you try to confront it or say something about it, there's just this denial of like, oh, well, we didn't think you would want to come get pedicures with us. And, you know, it's just kind of embarrassing that you showed up the same day we were there. And
wow.
Lots of little things like that that add up.
Yeah. You were talking about those comments that, that kind of put people in place just by these little violent mm-hmm. comments. And it reminded me, when I lived in Spokane, I don't know the exact year, but whatever year that Romney ran for president, it was around like probably earlier than 2012. I don't know the political campaign years, but I was part of the Relief Society book club that we had going on. And I believe I was in the presidency at that time because I was in two Relief Society presidencies in that ward back to back. So I was in for a long time in the presidency. And so I was part of that book club and we were, you know, you get off topic in a book club when we were talking about, you know, the election coming up. And I said out loud that I didn't think I was going to be voting for Romney. That's all I really said. I didn't go into why or anything like that. And then, like, I don't think anybody, like, I think there was some bristling and the conversation kind of moved on and that was it. And then later when we were eating refreshments, this older woman in the ward came up to me and she's like, so are you a convert? And I'm like, no, like it was out of the blue. And I didn't know why she was asking me this. And I was like, no, I'm not a convert. I was born in the church. And she's like, really? Well, like, were you ever inactive? And I'm like, no, like, why are you asking me these questions? Like, this is so weird. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, well, I just think that it's really like, that's really bold of you to say that you know, you won't be voting for Romney. And I'm like, what? And then it hit me why she was asking me these questions. Like, just because of who I was voting for president. And I was just like I walked away from that whole encounter and I'm like, I don't know if I should be upset and angry or if I should just be proud of myself for, you know, mm-hmm. like I can make my own decisions regardless of what, you know, I'm being told to make, you know, and it just like, and this was when I was an active Mormon, like super active. And there was no reason, like there was no like faith reason why I didn't want to vote for Romney. It was purely political. And so the fact that I would speak up and say, hey, I'm not voting for the Mormon, like automatically othered me in that group. And it was just, and then for her to come up and say those like a little, you know, slightly, you know, verbally violent things like othering me, like, oh, you must be a convert. Oh, you must have gone inactive. Oh, there's something about you that must have left the faith to even have that opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
it's crazy.
So, yeah, I mean, I see it with clients that are still active in the Mormon faith where, so maybe it's all just anecdotal, but I feel like the prettier you are and the more fit you are, the harder it will be for you to hold on to friendships in the Mormon church as a female.
Wow.
If you are not attached to a powerful man, so if your husband isn't in leadership, mm-hmm. Just that competitiveness between women, mm-hmm. There's so much jealousy, you're just going to be cut out. Mm-hmm. And over again, I see just really delightful, down-to-earth, kind people who happen to be really physically attractive, who can't make a friend in church to save their life. It's just, wow. Yeah.
I would have not have guessed that. Probably because that's not my description. But yeah. I would not have guessed that.
Yeah.
Huh. And why do you think that is?
I think there's this competitiveness, and for like the women who I'm thinking of, like if you're attached to somebody who's, you know, like in stake presidency or who's a bishop, that puts you in proximity to power where people are going to want to connect with you. Mm-hmm. And want to be friendship with you because you have power. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I don't know if it's this like legacy of polygamy and being worried that Mormon men are shopping for the next spouse for like the, you know, second, third, fourth wife, or mm-hmm. kind of where that legacy comes from, but just a lot of fear of attractive women are going to steal your spouse. A lot of criticism of what women are wearing at church. Like, are they modest enough? And then with all that we talk about modesty and like skin not being exposed, mm-hmm. there's this weird inverse relationship where like we're super into the designer handbags and, you know, like power suits from the department store that are only worn to church, you know, like never in any executive meetings. But maybe we need to think about it more, but just weird stuff going on with power and with women connecting with one another. And then just, I don't see a lot of friendships that survive the faith transition. It seems like a lot of the connections that are made kind of under that Mormon umbrella, they don't last when one of the friends leaves the faith.
Mm-hmm. So you do in your article go on to talk about what can we do as adults when we're targeted by relational aggression. We must reclaim connection using our voice and moving into responsive action. And so you do a beautiful job of giving us an action plan. Like, here's the problem. I'm going to describe it. You know, you relate to it. So here's what we can do to kind of fix the problem. So I want to spend the last amount of our time kind of talking about those points. Would you like me to read them?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Okay. So the first one that you bring up is speak. When it is safe to do so, speak up. Connect to safe people outside of the community where you are a target and name what is being done to you. That's a scary thought, right?
It is, yeah.
Describe the impact it is having on you, like make it personal. Discuss it with a therapist.
Yes.
Connect with support groups in person or online to validate what you are experiencing and to remind you what it is like to be received with kindness and respect. That's huge. And there are some great communities on Facebook. A lot of local cities also have in-person groups.
Yes.
I've just recently discovered here in Arizona, I've tapped into a wonderful group of women who they're all pretty fresh out of the church. And it's really hard in Arizona to connect with people in the ex-Mormon world, which is weird because there's a lot of us, but suddenly I've tapped into it. And it's a secret group, but it's huge. It's so big.
Yeah.
And it's like, I didn't even know that we all existed. And it's so good that we can all kind of get together and support one another all when we're all in the same place. And so I think it's really important that we find those groups, and they're out there. We just have to be open to looking for them and finding them. And we can start on Facebook. You can start on places that are virtual and kind of like work backwards to find, you know, to tease out where they are locally for you. Let's see, what else did you say? Interrupt the secrecy of the aggressors and you will begin to find relief from the shame of being targeted. If the relational aggression is coming from family or other permanent people in your life, rehearse with a therapist or friend how to tell them that they are hurting you. Practice saying no to interactions that will hurt you experiment with boundaries to keep you safe in the future. This is great advice. So did you want to talk a little bit about speak?
Sure. Yeah, like just naming what's going on, recognizing, noticing it, even if you're just saying it to yourself or writing it down in a journal or writing it down on a piece of paper that you burn or rip up and throw away. But it's going to help internally with that splitting, that enmity towards self that relational aggression can create, where you start to feel like there's part of yourself that you don't like, that you don't love, the part of yourself that is being rejected by other people. Mm-hmm. Where the speaking helps to quiet that and provide another voice. You know, could it be that I'm not an awful person who deserves to be shunned or spoken to disparagingly? Mm-hmm. Could it be I'm not the sort of person who should be left off the invitation list? Mm-hmm. Could it be that I'm okay? Could it be that other people are the ones who are behaving in a way that is not kind or respectful, that's inappropriate?
Mm-hmm.
And that starts to pull us out of that sense of there's something fundamentally wrong with me, I'm flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And then to strengthen that as we speak it to other people and connect with others, it starts to take root and get stronger, that sense of like, oh yeah, no, I'm actually okay. There's nothing wrong with me. It's what these mean people are doing that isn't okay.
Sorry, it reminded me of that meme that I've seen that says, you know, if you think that you're depressed, first maybe take a look around and make sure that you're not really actually surrounded by assholes. Like, to me, that's exactly what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like if your game plan is I'm going to like say the perfect thing or do the right thing and all of the assholes will be transformed into my best friends. Yeah, it's not going to happen.
No.
Like, yeah. And you like, really if don't any of, want it yeah.
To.
Yeah. 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 But that going out looking for other people, like, that's scary. It's scary to speak what's happening to you and to run that risk that someone will say, well, yeah, you deserve to be treated that way. That totally makes sense that they're shunning you, or yeah, I wouldn't invite you to my party either. And so learning to identify, you know, who it's safe to say things to and, who's got your back, who's going to be able to give you some good objective feedback. Mm-hmm. And those supportive people who are going to receive your truth that you speak to, that supportive audience, they're other to start with, you know, like they're not your community. They're not who you've been hanging out with. And so forging those connections is some brave work. It's hard. You don't know how it's going to go, and it might not go perfectly the first few times, but you keep trying, you keep reaching out until you start to find the right kind of people.
Yeah. It is really important. I remember when I went public sharing my BYU rape experience, it was when I was mentally still a believing member. And I was immediately labeled an anti-Mormon for sharing my experience because I read the comments like you're not supposed to do. And that was like a really tough thing for me. And it was Lindsay Hanson Park that kind of swooped me in and put me in a lot of ex-Mormon and feminist Mormon and progressive Mormon groups on Facebook. And she just like pushed me in and she was like, here, go find your people. Here, these people will support you. And she would like introduce me. And all of a sudden the support was just incredible, and it was exactly what I needed in that moment where I felt so lost, so isolated, so rejected by my faith community. And so it was so wonderful to find that support, and I just hope and pray that everybody, or you know, meditate that everybody can,
yeah
can find that kind of support, because it feels great and everyone deserves it. And there's, it's out there for everyone. It's just a matter of being in, you know, vulnerable and brave enough to go looking for it, and it will find you.
Yeah. I remember during kind of like the height of the Ordain Women, Kate Kelly controversy, I was here in Utah and was talking to the old ladies in my water aerobics class about what I was going through and like why it was so hard for me. And two of them were just like, oh, you know, like we're Episcopalian. We went through this in our church back in the 70s. You know, like it was hard. And like, and when women did get the priesthood, it wasn't even like the women you like who got into power, you know, it was like the ones who had been friendliest to the men, the ones who were closest to the men who were, you know, like the ones who were first to get power. But just being seen and heard by these women from another faith tradition, not in my age group at all, you know, just not who I would have thought of as like, oh, like these are my people. I'm going to reach out to, you know, like these retired ladies and they're going to connect with me. But they did. And just, it helped. It helped so much when I would read those awful comments, to just know, like, I'm not alone. Like somebody else has been through this. This is not a unique experience to me or even to my faith community. This is something that lots of other people in the world go through.
Mm-hmm. And something that just dawned on me when you were talking about like the women who are in power are usually the women who get along with the men. And all of a sudden I had this like aha moment where I'm like, you know, that was me. I was always getting chummy with the men. And I've always actually, I've looked back at my life and I'm like, is that a Mormon thing that I was taught to like seek the approval and attention of men? Or is that a cultural thing outside of Mormonism? Like, but I know that it was exacerbated by Mormonism. And it's something that I didn't really outlearn until I went through my faith transition and learned that I don't need that approval, that I can approve myself. Right. And that approval also, once you kind of leave a religious setting, if I'm constantly seeking the attention of men, like in my single, you know, between divorce, you know, between marriages life, like that would leave me, like land me in a lot of awkward situations that I didn't intend, you know, but that was the message that I was sending because that's what I was taught how to, as a survival tactic, like, okay, I have to, you know, be approved by the men in power and then I will be okay. I'll be safe. I'll be set. And like,
and it works as a survival tactic. You know, like I think of actual violence and I'm somebody who loves a good rock show and I love to be in the pit. Like the closer to the stage, the better. Like that's, I've gone to Coachella. I've gone to Riot Fest. Like I go to some big music festivals. And part of what gives me the courage, though, to be up there in the pit is that I travel with my younger brother, who's a pretty, like, you know, he's got muscles, like, he's a pretty strong guy, and so I have somebody who's going to push bodies back from slamming into me on one side of me, but then the other piece of my strategy is that, like, I look for, like, a big dude in the pit, and I flirt with him before the show starts, because... When things get violent, you know, like, yeah, I'm totally going to be feeble girl. And I want somebody on my other side who's going to like protect me from the bodies slamming towards me, you know, from the side that my brother's not on. And, you know, like that's sort of like pit survival, like how to be 5'2" and not get smashed.
Been there.
Yeah, and like it's a space though where you know, like male violence dominates and wins. Yeah. And I've been in plenty of pits where it gets to the point where I'm like, all right, I want to live. I'm just going to like step back and go watch the show from further away from this like circle of like flailing bodies that are going to hurt me.
Yeah. That's true.
And in the Mormon faith though, and in any space where you don't have power, we do these strategic things where, yeah, like how do I get my body as close as possible to the bodies who have power to navigate this space successfully.
Mm-hmm. It feels so manipulative, but I mean, it's human nature can be a bit manipulative when it comes to survival tactics. I mean, you naturally do what you got to do. And it isn't until we kind of look back and can see the root that we can kind of start to make changes, you know, with a deeper understanding and not act out of fear, but act, you know, meaningfully.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on to the second one. So the second one is move. Trauma is nastiest when we feel fear and we are trapped. It is 100% human and normal to feel fear and being rejected from a group that we believe we need to survive. Being trapped escalates fear to trauma. Some clients have moved their children to different schools to escape toxic PTA or choose to forego callings to attend a different ward. In a workplace case of relational aggression, documenting the acts creating a hostile work environment may allow you to find relief through a responsive manager or human resources department. If you are experiencing relational aggression in a physical community, moving to a new home in another ward, school district, neighborhood may not be a viable option. You have every reason to feel trapped. If you cannot physically remove yourself from the harm, is it possible to identify the needs you're trying to get met through connection to the aggressors? What resource are they hoarding as you experience scarcity? That's deep. Can you get what you need from someone else and emotionally move to a safer source? What other communities or connections might you nurture to eventually transition those needs to empathetic people? If you cannot easily remove yourself from the reach of the threat, are there boundaries you can set to reduce the harm being done to you? So did you have any thoughts about move?
Yeah, well, the first is just that economically, that might not be an option for a lot of people. That, you know, or if it's, you know, if it's your family members and you aren't ready to sever relationships with your in-laws or the extended family that are excluding you, that are saying cutting things, that are starting rumors, then it's time to do some pretty hard work, which is to get introspective and figure out, you know, like, what is it that I'm getting or that I'm hustling to get from these relationships?
Yeah.
What is it that I'm dreaming of? What do I want to experience? Like, why do I keep putting my hand in the tiger cage and, you know, like getting it snapped at or scratched or bitten off? You know, like it's, what is it that I'm looking for? Yeah. And then starting to look for that elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like when I moved to Utah and tried to go walking or like set up movie dates with sisters in the ward that I was in, just wasn't happening. I was not succeeding in connecting with others. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have female friends. I wanted to have connections to people besides my sister, my mom, you know, kind of immediate relatives in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, started going to events that, you know, like Mormon feminist type of events, like things where I would see my people, people who had ideas similar to mine. And that's where I started to find friends and connections and people who were like, hey, come to this book group, or have you been to this? Or like Mormon Stories podcast is having this event. And, you know, through those things, I started to find people that I could have social connection to that were accepting of me just as I am without having to change my belief systems. Without me having to get married, without me having to do these things that Mormons ask you to perform in order to belong in the group.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. So, and these communities don't, like, they don't have to be huge. They can be small. These communities can evolve with you. You can find a community. Like for me, I went kind of from Mormonism to, I started attending a mom's group at a local Christian church. And I did that for a couple of years. Yeah. That was really a rough transition, but I craved the interaction with the women. So I went despite all of this like God talk that I was really not okay with. God, after I was leaving the church, like Mormon God was like the most hateful person in the world. So I was like, don't talk about God, but I really need these relationships and I really need this conversation and this acceptance. And so I would just kind of like keep all of my internal struggles quiet and I would, you know, conform to the group because I needed the group. And like, that was a fine transition. But then I finally, after about 2 years, just this past semester, I'm like, I started being more vocal about like, hey, well, I'm more, you know, I don't identify as a Christian and I don't read the Bible, but I can still find good messages within these stories that you're sharing. And this is what I found out, but I was trying to kind of normalize my belief. And then I just finally got to a point where I'm like, I think I've graduated. Like I'm grateful for the time I spent in it, but I need to evolve now. And so like I've just stepped out, and instead of spending time in these groups, I've started spending time on individual people that I've chosen to be my people.
Yeah.
And it's just an evolution of whatever you need, and give yourself permission to make choices that are better for you. Don't feel like you are stuck somewhere just because it's meeting some need that you need. Like, find that somewhere else where you can be, you know, where it feels safer, basically.
And I think be gentle with yourself in that process, because brainwashing will show up. Mm-hmm. You'll behave suddenly in a way where it's just like, wait, what is happening? What is this thought that is going through my head? And just being curious about it, noticing. So for me, this came up most recently. I have a subscription to the Broadway season here in Salt Lake City. And I had a show where, like, I think I was going to take my mom and she'd had to travel. And so I had an extra ticket. And instead of just approaching people individually, I put it out there to my social work team at the hospital. To see if anybody wanted to go with me. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to like make some new connections. And So the first person who was interested in going was a male colleague, you know, and there's only like two male social workers on the whole team. And I had feelings about it where I was like, oh, like, am I, you know, like, am I trying to steal somebody's husband? Like, Mormon women can't be alone with like a married Mormon man, because temple covenants will be broken and, you know, like terrible things will happen. And I just noticed that I was having all kinds of like judgy thoughts in my head about whether or not this would be okay. And so I just listened to that and just was like, okay, yeah, like, where do these thoughts come from? And just noticing what was coming up for me. And then talking to colleagues about it, you know, talking to some friends where I'm like, oh, I'm having like a Mormon faith transition thing happening. Can I just tell you about like what Mormons believe and how that's showing up? And, you know, they were like, yeah, sure. And so over lunch, I talked to some people about it and they were like, yeah, no, like, it's okay. Like, it's normal that like you're having these thoughts, like it makes sense where you're coming from. And it's really going to be fine. Like, no marriages will be ruined. No affairs will start. And sure enough, like, I went to the theater with a male colleague who's married and neither of us cheated. Like, there was no like hooking up during intermission. Like, it was really a-okay and just nice to connect with somebody. And within the Mormon world, I think those gender roles are so prescribed that it's hard to conceptualize friendships with men that don't lead to sex, that aren't about, you know, being married for the eternities, you know, as a first, second, or fifth wife or whatever. those ideas are hard for us to let go of, and I think can complicate forming friendships, regardless of whether they're with men or with women.
Absolutely. It's so funny that you talked about like that judging programming, that brainwashing that you have going on.
Yes.
I went to dinner with two friends of mine. One of them is beginning her feminine awakening faith transition, but she's still technically attending, and another one has left. And we were talking about this issue and how they find themselves still judging women that like will wear tank tops, and like they'll hear the thought go through their head, and then they'll look down and be like, "But I'm wearing a tank top." It's so funny, because it's like you don't care, you don't really care, but the thought still goes through your mind like you do, and you're like, "What is that? I don't like that's not me." And so I shared like, because I've kind of grown away from like. I still garment check Mormons just because I want an, I like more active Mormons who don't wear garments. Those are my people. And like, just like, I want to talk to them and be like, what's going on? Like, tell me more. I just want to know. So like, but it's not because I'm judging them. It's because I like want to talk to them. But what the thing that I do find myself, like the thought that I'm having such a hard time getting rid of is sexual promiscuity. Like for me, hearing about a woman's sexual promiscuity, like in my Mormon mind that's still there, I'm like, oh, that horrible person. And like, there's so much judgment, but like me, I don't care. Like, I think that's great. I think consensual sexual activity is like, that's when you really have graduated from Mormon shame. It's when you can embrace that lifestyle and you can live for yourself. And so like me, like, cognitively, like I'm all for it, but then when I hear about it, like there's these voices and I'm like, well, go away, like I don't want you anymore. It's so hard.
And I think especially around sexuality and pleasure, Mormon women sacrifice so much. Yes. And, like, we shut ourselves down, we wear this super ugly underwear, you know, like we do all these hard things, and so when somebody leaves and rejects the things that we didn't really want to be doing in the first place, like there's this feeling of just like, she can't do that. Like, you can't leave and like be happy. Like, you have to suffer and be miserable, because the only way to happiness is to follow the rules, is to do all these things. And because there's this scarcity of freedom, and there's this scarcity of joy, and the scarcity of connecting to body and feeling pleasure, an area where a lot of us can be triggered into some mean girl behavior of our own is when we see people stepping outside of the boundaries that to us feel like the rules of belonging.
Right.
And then we don't enact physical violence, but then I gossip to my friends about, oh, did you see so-and-so? Like, you know, like she wears her garments to church on Sunday, but she's wearing like her Lululemon all week long. Like, do you ever see her wearing garments during the week? You know, like it's
silly. So silly.
Yeah. Yeah. Petty. Really petty, but.
And oh, so in closing, let's see. Finally, we can improve all the communities we engage in for connection by doing the hardest thing and minding our own tendencies toward relational aggression, even our little Mormon thoughts. Where do you feel you have the least power, and where do you feel the most insecure? These are the spaces to ask, Lord, is it I? And to notice when we are judging others as our means of connection, to notice when we are being the information broker, spreading news and stories that do not belong to us, to be on the lookout for our own tendency towards secrecy, silence, and judgment, and to note when it is hardest for us to express empathy. It is never too late to reject relational aggression and begin to cultivate authentic connections built on empathy and vulnerability. When have you been on the receiving end of relational aggression, and what did you do about it? How did you survive? Those are some great follow-up questions.
Yeah. So I'm a huge fan of Brené Brown, and she talks about hot-wiring connection through what I would describe as a mean girl behavior. She calls it common enemy intimacy, where... You bond with someone over having a common enemy. Mm-hmm. And it creates an intimacy and connection where, you know, like I bond with the other person waiting to pick up kids because we're both wearing garments. And, you know, Lululemon, who I just shamed in our conversation, mm-hmm. you know, is over there with her kid and she's not wearing her garments. Or it can be just the reverse, you know, like I'm so woke and over the Mormon thing and I've escaped the bonds of the patriarchy and let me get together with my fellow post-mos and, you know, like drink mimosas to how awesome we are and how stupid the members of our family who are still in the church are. And like it's we're connecting, but we're connecting as we shame someone else. And it's not a good kind of connecting.
You know, it's not genuine and it's not going to bring about the best in either of you.
And ultimately it leaves us with that feeling of, oh, like we're talking about that person today, but what do they say about me when I'm not here? And, mm-hmm. you know, they're wondering the same thing about you. And it's just,
trust within women when you have that relational aggression going on, even if it's like, even if it's like post-Mormons towards Mormons, that's still relational aggression, like you said, and it still fosters that mistrust between women. Ugh, so hard.
Yeah, it is. It's really hard to unlearn. And I think it's just catching yourself at it when you do it and, mm-hmm. and trying to do better, like figuring out, you know, like, oh, what was it that I was feeling? What was happening that I went with like cheap and dirty connection instead of a vulnerable, authentic, real connection?
Yeah, that was tough. Well, fantastic. Thank you, April. Did you have any closing thoughts before we end our wonderful conversation about...
Oh, I feel like I've rambled so much.
Well, I feel better. I think that this is a really tough, as a Mormon woman, this is a really tough topic that I still have a long way to go to kind of work through all of my, you know, mistrust and, you know, fear of being vulnerable and where I seek attention and approval and power mm-hmm. and all those things. And so it's a lot to think about. But I really am grateful for the time that you took to kind of go over that, well, write the great article as we were communicating and then be willing to come on and present it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, very welcome.
Now, where can people find you if they would like to find you, April? Is that something that you're comfortable with?
Oh yeah, sure. So, I mean, if you're looking for me online, like Facebook, Instagram, I have an April Carlson LCSW Instagram that I aspire to post more. I blog for The Exponent. And then if you're local and looking for a therapist, I'm with The Healing Group, which is in Midvale, Utah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, April. And you enjoy the rest of your Sabbath.
Thank you. I will.
That wraps up today's topics. We are so glad you stopped by. Be sure to join the Mormon Happy Hour on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon. If you smiled, please drop us a 5-star review wherever you found us. See you next week. Cheers!